This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Taliban are preparing to unveil their new government more than 2 weeks after the takeover of Afghanistan that brought an end to the 20 years of US-led war. Israeli forces fire rubber bullets and tear gas to disperse Palestinian protesters in the Gaza Strip, wounding several of them. Also in the headlines, more than 1 million homes and businesses remain without electricity in Louisiana and Mississippi 3 days after Hurricane Ida hit the U.S. states. The Taliban are preparing to unveil a new government in Afghanistan after taking almost full control of the war-torn country. The Taliban official, Ahmadullah Muttaqi, said a ceremony is being prepared at the presidential palace in Kabul. Local news outlets have also said that an announcement on a new government is imminent. The Taliban's top figures, including the group's supreme leader, Haybatullah Akhundzadeh, are in Afghanistan. The group seized the capital and rest of the country in a matter of weeks last month. The U.S. also pulled out its remaining troops from there before the August 31st deadline, ending its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan. The Taliban have showcased some of the American military hardware they captured during their takeover of Afghanistan. During the military parade, a long line of Humvees and other armored vehicles flying white and black Taliban flags drove a highway outside the city of Kandahar. The parade was held to celebrate the exit of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. The Taliban also flew an Afghan Army Black Hawk helicopter during the celebrations. The British Foreign Secretary has admitted that the intelligence failure led the government to believe the Afghan capital Kabul wouldn't fall to the Taliban by the end of the year.
The central assessment that we were operating to, and it was certainly backed up by both the JIC and the military, is that the central proposition was that given the troop withdrawal by the end of August, you would see a steady deterioration from that point, and that it was unlikely Kabul would fall this year. That was the central assessment.
Raab was addressing an emergency session of the Foreign Affairs Committee. He said Britain may need to develop its own capabilities for specific military missions overseas without the U.S. He made the remarks in reference to the U.S. move to withdraw its troops from Afghanistan and leaving the U.K. with no viable alternative coalition. The government of Prime Minister Boris Johnson has come under fire by parliamentarians over its handling of the UK's pullout of Afghanistan. So the Taliban are preparing to unveil a new government in Afghanistan after taking almost full control of the war-torn country. You've got Taliban officials said the ceremony is being held or prepared at the presidential palace, and top figures from the Taliban, including their supreme leader, are in Afghanistan. To discuss that further, let's bring in Munir Ahmed, journalist and political analyst, joining us out of Islamabad. Munir, welcome. You know, the Taliban have on many occasions promised a new inclusive government in Afghanistan. Do you think they're going to live up to that?
They have promised that they will be having a very inclusive government in Afghanistan and all the neighboring countries, and the stakeholders of peace in the region have emphasized on the inclusive government. And the Taliban have reiterated their promise, but still we see no such kind of the process where they could have inclusive government. And without any inclusive government, Taliban cannot run the Afghanistan government, and also they cannot come into bilateral and multilateral relationships. But unfortunately, we don't see such kind of process where they could have engaged different stakeholders in the region. Please.
Yes. Munir, we've also heard from the Taliban, they've given many promises and pledges and statements that the new government will not be similar to the one 20 years ago. How do you think a new government in Afghanistan will look like with the Taliban in power?
We appreciate the present leadership of Afghan Taliban talking to different countries in their terms. For example, they have spoken to China in their terms. They have spoken to Iran in their language, and they have also assured the strategies that could favor Pakistan. And such is the condition that have promised with America and Britain and European countries if they pull out their forces from Afghanistan within due date. America has done it Monday late, and I believe afterwards they will have more lenient and more cordial relationship with America. On the other hand, Britain has also taken it very seriously and pulling out their troops. And I don't know like if some of their troops remains in Afghanistan. But this is a very welcome thing that UK and US has pulled out their troops, and they have fulfilled the promises they had with Afghan Taliban. And recently we have seen UN Security Council admitting Taliban's name from the terrorist groups. They have termed already, like they do not expect some kind of extremist or terrorist behavior from the groups. So it is another kind of inclination that UN secretly or like without announcing it has accepted Taliban in Afghanistan. And we also have seen America's lenient view of Afghan Taliban. And thirdly, as we have seen their promises, they would have more human rights in Afghanistan, and they will not be strict as they were in their previous regime. And women have a right to work, and there will be education, and they also have a promise to give equal opportunities to women. That is a more, what we should say, is a welcome step of Taliban. But after forming the government, what would be their attitude towards their people and implementation of Sharia, what all, they have their own interpretation of Sharia. So it would depend on them, how they keep their promises.
Mr. Ahmed, thank you very much indeed for your time and your thoughts. Munir Ahmed, the journalist and political analyst, joining us out of Islamabad. Ahmed Kabello says the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan has been a real disaster for the United Kingdom's image in the world.
They knew very little about the traditions, the custom, or the very setup of Afghan society. And despite the fact the Taliban would constantly remind the occupiers that you have the time, you have the watch, but we have the time, which was an indication that as soon as the occupation forces left, that they would take over and be back in charge. So these are sure tell signs of an empire in decline. And this very public spat between the United States and the United Kingdom is also an indication that the United Kingdom is no longer as useful an ally as it once was. Now, Dominic Raab was one of the key architects and cheerleaders for Brexit, and his ambition was that he would work with a Donald Trump administration closely. But Joe Biden's administration clearly sees the UK outside of the European Union as a less useful ally than it was when it was inside the European Union. So all round, it's been a disaster, and it's been a real disaster for Britain's image on the world because it's been embarrassed by its senior partner, the United States.
Israeli forces have violently attacked Palestinians protesting against the Israeli blockade for the fifth consecutive day near the buffer zone in the Gaza Strip. A number of protesters, including a young Gazan, were wounded after Israeli forces fired rubber-coated bullets and tear gas at them. Dozens of others also suffered breathing difficulties after inhaling tear gas. Two people have been killed and dozens of others have been wounded since anti-Israel protests began at the weekend. Demonstrators say they will continue their protests until the regime lifts its blockade on the Strip. The territory has been under a tight Israeli air and sea blockade since 2007. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has given us an update on the violent attack by Israeli forces against Palestinian demonstrators in the town of Rafah in the Gaza Strip.
We've seen this throughout the last week and last night in the east of the southern Gaza Strip town of Rafah. Young Palestinians were attacked by Israeli snipers who used live bullets, rubber-coated metal bullets, and also tear gas canisters, not only to fire tear gas towards the protesters to disperse them, but also to target them directly in the face and in the upper limbs, as they did in 2018, where at least two dozen protesters during the Great March of Return were killed by tear gas canisters, where Israeli soldiers were fired directly in the faces of children and medics and journalists during the those peaceful rallies. Palestinian youth are planning a mass rally tonight in the east of Gaza City to further exert pressure on the Israeli regime and in order to lift its hermetic and inhuman blockade against them that's been in place since 2007.
A Russian broker ceasefire has taken hold in Syria's southern city of Daraa following weeks of clashes between the government forces and Western-backed militants. Media belonging to both sides have confirmed the agreement. As part of the deal, Russian military police are deployed in Daraa's al-Balad, the militant-held old quarter of the city. The deal also involves the disarming or expulsion of a dozen terrorists who the Syrian government considered as a threat to the ceasefire agreement. Over the past weeks, the area has witnessed heavy fighting that led to dozens of militants and a number of soldiers being killed and many residents in the area being forced to flee their homes. Bahraini people have staged a rally protesting against the kingdom's normalization of ties with Israel. Protesters held banners and chanted slogans stressing that normalization of ties is an act of betrayal to the Muslim world. Meanwhile, Bahrain's dissolved opposition party, Al-Wafaq, condemned the move as a treason and a disgrace. Palestine's Hamas resistance movements also slammed the move, saying the enemy should know that normalization is just an illusion and the Palestinian people will neither forget nor forgive those who stand by the occupier. The reaction came after Bahrain sent an ambassador to Tel Aviv on Tuesday as Manama's first ever envoy in Israel. Bahrain was one of the four Arab states that normalized relations with the Israeli regime under a deal brokered by the US last year. Political commentator Michael Springman says the normalization of ties with Israel is a one-sided deal for the benefit of Tel Aviv.
The people themselves see through to the heart of the matter that it's all in Israel's interest to divide the Arab world, and they have help from the United Nations special mediator for the so-called peace process, who believes that they should help the Israelis work out an arrangement for a two-state solution. Well, the Zionists created Israel by stealing Palestine from its native people with the help of the United States, Britain, and the rest of the European countries, who simply wanted to dump their Jews into somebody else's country and get them the hell out of Europe. So it's no one has gotten anything out of it except the Israelis and some of these narrow-minded, repressive and repulsive Arab governments. They see advantages in being able to buy Israeli spyware like Pegasus to use against their own people. They see that they might get some advantages in trade and aid and tourism from the Israelis, but it's all one-sided. It's not going to make much of a difference.
More than a million homes and businesses remain without electricity in Louisiana and Mississippi 3 days after Hurricane Ida hit the U.S. states. Evacuees who fled the Category 4 hurricane before it devastated southern Louisiana are being urged not to return home yet, with power out across the region. Some areas of Louisiana are expected to be without electricity for up to a month. This can be deadly during the oppressive heat in the state. Many areas in the region still lack running water or have sewage systems that are not fully operational. Six people have been killed so far, with countless homes destroyed and towns flooded. That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
the supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. In the limelight.
U.S. hospitalizations due to COVID-19 have topped a two-week average of 100,000, according to the New York Times. This is the highest rate of hospitalizations due to COVID recorded in the U.S. since last winter, when rates reached record highs. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Sharon Zhang Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. COVID hospitalization rate tops 100,000, highest since winter's peaks. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. U.S. hospitalizations due to COVID-19 have topped a two-week average of 100,000, according to the New York Times. This is the highest rate of hospitalizations due to COVID recorded in the U.S. since last winter, when rates reached record highs. As mask mandates and restrictions have lifted over the past month, hospitalizations have increased exponentially. They reached lows in June, but in July, they began rising again. Over the course of about 2 months, average hospitalization rates went from a one-week average of around 17,000 to over 100,000, The highest COVID hospitalization rates recorded in the pandemic so far occurred in January 2021, following the winter holidays. Over 137,000 people were hospitalized on average then. While the U.S. hospitalizations have been rising steadily, the number of cases appears to be reaching a peak. But the U.S. isn't in the clear yet. Deaths due to COVID are still on the rise, reaching new highs after rates had dipped early in the summer. High hospitalization rates have been overwhelming hospitals across the United States. In some places, especially at large hospitals serving urban areas, they have been forced to transfer COVID patients to facilities in other towns, sometimes far away, to receive care. In southern states with low vaccination rates, meanwhile, hospitals are running out of oxygen. Normally, an oxygen tank would be about 90% full, and the supplies would let them get down to a refill level of 30 to 40% left in their tank, giving them a 3 to 5 day cushion of supply. Donna Cross, Senior Director of Facilities and Construction for Healthcare Improvement Company Premier, told CNN, adding, "What's happening now is that hospitals are running down to about 10 to 20%, which is a 1 to 2 day supply on hand before they are getting backfilled." Supply issues and shortages have especially become a problem in Florida, where the pandemic is worse than it has ever been. Since the end of July and through August, hospitalizations nearly tripled as the Delta variant ripped through the state. Overall, Florida is doing worse than early every other state on several metrics, with the highest number of cases and highest number of people hospitalized per 100,000 at 106 and 77, respectively. The situation is so dire that the mayor of Orlando had to ask residents to conserve water so that the city would keep supplying oxygen to patients. Despite all of it, though, Governor Ron DeSantis has been holding firm against vaccine and mask mandates, causing his approval ratings to plummet. High hospitalization numbers across the U.S. are particularly concerning because they are happening despite over half of the country being fully vaccinated, suggesting that the cases would be even higher if there were no vaccines to inoculate against the virus. Researchers in July found that the U.S. vaccine campaign has saved around 279,000 lives and prevented about 1.25 million people from being hospitalized. Indeed, cases have risen since rates of vaccination slowed and politicians began lifting mask and social distancing mandates. Vaccines are being administered at a rate of about 886,000 doses a day, down from averages of over 3 million earlier this year. Meanwhile, as of the beginning of July, all states except for Hawaii had fully reopened, and only a handful of states have re-implemented COVID guidelines. Researchers are saying that they expect over 100,000 more deaths due to COVID from August to December. If the pandemic continues as it has been, largely unabated among the unvaccinated, save for some places that have re-implemented mask mandates. 100,000 deaths was once deemed by the New York Times to be an incalculable loss, but now the United States approaches a new grim milestone as it nears 640,000 deaths and counting.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
So I'm going to come, and then I said, make sure you tell your mum now quickly and tell her to get your brothers and stuff. And she said, okay, cool, see you later. And then I said to her, see you later, and then put the phone down, and that was the last time I spoke to her.
We could see people at the windows. You know, it's such something that stays with you forever. It stays etched on your mind. You can't remove it. It's awful.
Our children have experienced things that other children that are in a war zone had experienced. They saw people that were jumping out of windows, and then people that were in fire, like running out of the building. They remember the smell, the smoke, all of that.
No one has to go through this sort of pain again, never ever.
Grenfell Tower was a death trap because it was safer before it was refurbished.
They covered the building in essentially solid petrol.
The Conservative majority here at the council constructed policies to get rid of those people that were seen as a cost on the housing benefit.
Seeing us as troublemakers and a threat.
They would have much rather that community not be in that fire.
Institutional racism has been the elephant in the room. It's an uncomfortable truth for a lot of people because we like to think that society has progressed.
If no one goes to prison for this at all, then as far as I'm concerned, people have gotten away with murder.
The Grenfell Tower Fire.
Part 1.
This is the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, the wealthiest borough in the whole of the United Kingdom. It is home to the Kensington Palace, luxury department stores such as Harrods, and many celebrities and notable political figures. It is also home to one of the greatest peacetime disasters in the UK since the Second World War, the Grenfell Tower Fire.
Well, that concludes the Phase 1 hearings, and we shall be in touch in due course to let you know when we're going to sit again.
The public inquiry into the fire has now ended its first phase, with the second phase unlikely to start until 2020. Many people gave some shocking testimonies during the past few months, including firefighters as well as survivors.
He looked like he was just sleeping, as babies do. You know, at that moment, we felt like our hearts had broken. And it had. At least we were able to tell them.
Marcio Gomez is the father of the youngest victim of the Grenfell fire, an unborn baby named Logan. He led his family of four to a miraculous escape from the 21st floor.
It was pitch black, smoke. You couldn't breathe. As soon as you open the door, you just get this woof of black smoke just come in, and it was very overpowering. We got out at 3:30, give or take, purely because we had to. The fire had come through the bedroom window, and my bedroom was on fire at that point. So I was lucky enough to spot it coming in, and when it did come in, I immediately closed my door, and I turned around to the girls and our neighbour, who was obviously still there with us, and I said, the fire's reached our flat, we need to get out, and it's now or never. There was bodies on the stairwell, because it was pitch black. You couldn't see who or the faces. Obviously, I know it was my neighbours, from around the tower, but don't know who they were. But it was difficult stepping and tripping over the bodies that were in the stairwell.
More than a year after the fire, Marcio still breaks into tears when asked about Logan.
I was devastated.
My wife. She's made of the hardest material I know. And without her strength and courage, I would not be here.
Sadly, Marcio's next-door neighbors, the El Wahabi family, didn't make it alive. It was the holy month of Ramadan in the Muslim calendar. The night before, the family had broken their fast and prayed together. Nur Huda, their only daughter, was revising for her GCSE exams. Her last phone conversation was with her closest friend, Yusra.
She sounded calm when she was speaking to me. She's just woken up. Me and my mum woke her up because my mum and me called her. So she said, "Oh, your mum, you and your mum have been calling me." And I said to her, "There's a fire in your block." I said, "It's spreading a bit higher." I said, "It's about on the fourth floor now." I said, "Tell your mum and like hurry up." I said, "Just come." I said, "Just come out." I said, "Because it's going a bit higher." And I said, "I don't know if it's going to reach your floor or it's going to go into your flat." And she's like, "Oh, okay then." And I said, "Hurry up then." She's like, "Okay, cool." She's like, "I'm going to come." And then I said, "Make sure you tell your mum now quickly and tell her to get your brothers and stuff." And she said, "Okay, cool, see you later." And then I said to her, "See you later." And then put the phone down. That was the last time I spoke to her.
Nur Huda and her family were last seen trying to escape. But at the staircase, they were told to go back up by other fleeing residents. The order had come from the firefighters for people to stay put within their flats.
Well, I think the whole basis of fire protection in a building like Grenfell, but not just that high on many buildings, is what we call compartmentation. That the idea should be that a fire should be contained within what we call the compartment of origin, which might be a room or a flat, so that therefore there should be fire-resisting walls, fire-resisting floor, ceiling, doors and windows and so on, and that should stop the fire from spreading outside of where it starts. That allows the occupants to escape from the flat and to make their way out of the building, and firefighters to then enter the building with firefighting equipment and to extinguish the fire in that flat of origin. And that's the whole basis of what is described as stay put. That is a policy of the building, not necessarily of the fire service, but the fire service operates on the basis of that advice that has been given to residents. And clearly what happened at Grenfell is that a whole system that should restrict the fire to the original flat completely and utterly failed.
Can you tell us, first of all, whether you've ever had any training or experience of revoking stay put?
No, I haven't.
Right. There's no training and no experience as far as you're personally concerned. No. Do you know whether in the brigade there was, as at the 14th of June 2017, any training on how to go about revoking stay put?
Not that I was aware of.
No.
An official report has now confirmed that the failure of the London Fire Brigade to evacuate the building immediately made all the difference between life and death. The initial cause of the fire was a malfunctioning fridge freezer in flat 16 on the fourth floor. The first call to the fire services was made at 54 minutes past midnight.
Fire brigade?
Yeah, hello, hi. In the fire, flat 16 Greenfield Tower.
Sorry, a fire where?
Flat 16 Greenfield Tower. In the fridge.
Why, hang on.
Like Sting Greenfield Tower. It's the fourth floor.
Right, okay.
Quick.
They're on their way already. Yes, I know it's burning, but they are on their way. You've only just called, as long as you're okay.
15 minutes later, the firefighters enter flat 16 and attempt to eliminate the fire. The yellow glow in this thermal video is the fire which can be seen next to the kitchen window. Just over 10 minutes later, the fire in the kitchen was fully extinguished. Sadly, it was too little, too late, and the fire had already reached the extremely flammable cladding that covered the tower. Within minutes, the fire had raced up the exterior of the building. By 1:30 a.m., it reached the top floors. Antonio Roncolato was a resident on the 10th floor of Grenfell Tower. He had just come back from Italy the night before and gone to bed at 10 p.m. for an early start the next day. He was woken up at 1:40 a.m. by a phone call from his son Christopher, who was returning home from a late shift at work.
So when I saw the picture of the tower, I said, my God, what is going on here? So it was really, that one really shook me and it woke me up. And then I realized, oh, you know, I'm in trouble here. So I got dressed, I tried to go out, but as I touched the door to try to assess the situation, the door was very hot, was very, very warm. I opened a little bit, I had smoke coming right into my eyes, into my face. I closed the door promptly, and I could not see anything. It was totally black, very hot, very acrid smoke. And then I went to the bathroom, I rinsed my face a little bit in my eyes, and then I said, okay, now, you know, we have to, you know, you have to really, you cannot make any mistake. You have to analyze exactly and focus what you're doing, because that could be the last mistakes you do if you do a mistake now. So basically, I was continuously in touch with Christopher, and the fire brigade, the firemen downstairs, told me, stay put, somebody's coming to get you.
Antonio was the second to last person rescued by the firefighters. He survived in his flat for almost 5 hours.
I knew that was not my day. I knew I would make it alive. I knew I had a strong conviction and faith that, yes, they told me to stay put and they will come and get me. They did. And the only thing is that my son, Christopher, because don't forget, more than 4 hours, me inside pacing around and Christopher, my son, downstairs looking at the tower burning, a torch getting bigger and bigger, you know, brighter and brighter. So basically, Christopher was very stressed. And at one stage, I had to reassure him, Christopher, be cool, be calm, because he was worried about me. He was death worried about me. And I said, because this is not my day, and, I'm going to make it out alive. Don't you worry.
Many people like Antonio were given hope by the firefighters that they would be rescued. They started waving white towels from their windows to make sure their flats are noticed from outside.
From what I know now, it was very difficult to reach the top floors. Although I would have preferred knowing that that was the case, rather than them telling me, we're making you a priority, we're sending somebody up. If they knew they weren't going to reach, at least tell me that you're not going to reach. I could have tried something different. I could have tried to leave earlier. You know, there's so many scenarios.
For the already traumatized survivors of Grenfell, a horrifying rehousing process awaited.
Well, we spent 3 weeks in the hospital. King's College Hospital. My bedroom was a hospital bed, basically. My wife and my daughters were all put into into a coma because they were trying to get rid of all the poisoning that was inside them. They were diagnosed and treated for cyanide poisoning. The Portuguese consulate was actually there the following day. So they were very quick to respond and to get there. The council or anybody like that, not a whole week went past, they still weren't there.
The grieving families had to fight the council for their right to a new home. A council that was already found to have £274 million in its reserves in the immediate aftermath of the fire. Yusra lived in Grenfell Walk at the foot of the tower. Following the fire, she was evacuated along with her family, who were placed in a hotel for almost a year.
Some people think that because you're in a hotel, they think that it's cool because, oh, hotel, you get this and you get stuff, and it's nothing, it's the complete opposite. It's, you can imagine living in your bedroom and then your parents' bedroom, and that's where a family of five people had to live. That's the situation we had to live. We had to wash the dishes in the bath because the sinks were always getting blocked, and we couldn't, because obviously it was a bathroom sink, so we couldn't wash the dishes in there, so we had to get in the bath. We had to send washing off to my nan's house. We washed the clothes in our nan's house. You're literally overnight been put into something that's the size of your bedroom, and you've been put in there to live with the whole family, and it's all cramped up and everything. It's completely different. It drives you crazy. You feel like you're in a room where you're just trapped and you can't get out of it, and it's literally you cannot get out of it until, you know, obviously until we're housed and stuff. So it's horrible. It's nothing like some people are thinking.
You do everything in that room. You eat in that room. The girls have to do their homework on the bed. You know, you watch TV on your bed. It's just a hotel room. It's made for short stays, one or two nights, maybe even a week. You know, you hang up a few shirts if you're going to work and that kind of thing. But to live inside it, it's very, very difficult. It's the basics that you realise that you miss. You know, just making some toast, putting some butter on the toast. You can't even do that. It's quite difficult.
The Prime Minister, Theresa May, had promised that all the affected families would be rehoused within 3 weeks. More than a year after the fire, there are still over 50 families living in hotels, with a further 40 residing in temporary accommodations. The rehousing process has been described as truly shameful.
Why is it taking so long? You know, I just can't imagine why it is taking such a long time just to find people homes.
Someone needs to step up, because they said 3 weeks, everyone's going to be housed, but there's still people not housed today. I don't understand what's that hard.
This was not the first time fire had broken out at Grenfell. Over the 3 decades that Antonio and his son had lived in the tower, they had witnessed multiple other fires. Before some major refurbishments to the tower in 2014, all such incidents were contained within a single flat. This time, however, it was a whole different story.
I think Grenfell Tower was a death trap because the evidence suggests it was safer before it was regenerated or refurbished. All the fire safety measures which would have been designed into the building when it was built in 1974 had been compromised by what was done to the building. So the fire lifts didn't work, the smoke extraction system didn't work, the fire doors were not appropriate, the windows had failed, and of course the cladding that had been applied meant that fire, which should not be allowed to spread up the side of an or outside of a building, did indeed very rapidly spread up the outside of the building. So on every front, the fire protection measures, as we call them, were completely failing.
They had a choice between more fire-resistant cladding and less fire-resistant cladding. What they actually chose was the less fire-resistant cladding, which was at a cheaper price, marginally cheaper, because the project was around just under £10 million to do.
I just can't believe how central government or local government can allow a building to be covered in what's essentially petrol, you know, in a more solid form. I know there's austerity measures and everything, you know, that everybody's trying to save money in some way or form. But you should not be allowed to save money if you're putting people in danger, you know, or at risk. And basically that's what it did.
To this day, the company that made the combustible cladding still denies responsibility and blames the failing of the windows for the rapid spread of the fire. The US-based giant Arconic describes the claddings as being, at most, a contributing factor. Professor Lawrence Harwood of the University of Reading claims to know why the aluminium cladding is the main factor to blame for the rapid spread of fire. His theory is based around the violent reaction of aluminium with water.
It's a well-known fact that aluminium reacts very violently with water, and it occurred to me that the Celotex foam insulation, which was exposed to the atmosphere, could well, over time, have absorbed atmospheric moisture from rain. And then started adding things together that the moisture from the Celotex foam impinging on hot aluminium could then start a reaction that would then generate a lot of heat and generate hydrogen, which would again burn, generating more heat and regenerating water. And then at some point the polyethylene could become exposed, that would then burn and produce yet more water, and at that point you'd get a runaway reaction and the fire would spread very rapidly. As soon as water hits the aluminium surface, there's a huge energy spike. A lot of energy is released as a consequence of now the water reacting with aluminium. So it's counterintuitive that water would make matters worse in that sense, but small amounts of water, so that they don't cool down the aluminium but react with it to cause this violent exotherm, will cause this reaction to occur.
It is this interaction of the water released from the insulating foam that ultimately turned the aluminium cladding into fuel for the rapid spread of fire.
The chemistry is well-known chemistry. It's undergraduate level chemistry. The question is how people put two and two together. I've spoken to several architects and building engineers, and they all have problems comprehending the idea that aluminium itself can burn violently, particularly when it reacts with water. And this, the whole idea that water makes matters worse, again, people seem to have trouble with this. But in fact, the aluminium, unlike wood burning in air, the aluminium burns in the water, and it takes the oxygen out of the water. And that's why you get hydrogen, which itself burns.
The findings have been handed over to the inquiry in form of a letter. While his letter has been acknowledged, no one from the inquiry has followed up on his request to provide evidence.
I think it's very important that further work be carried out into this hypothesis in order that we can get to the truth of the matter, for the sake of the people who died, for the sake of their families, and in order to ensure that such a situation never happens again. We really do need to get to the truth of the matter.
The risk of cladding and the risk of fire spread as a result of cladding is a key issue that needs to be looked at. We believe that it should have been known about. We made warnings a long time ago, as long as 1999, following a previous fire. There have been other cladding fires around the world, and it's our view that people in authority, in the both the fire service but at government level, should have been aware of this risk and could have been therefore planning for it. What was very clear is that on the ground it wasn't widely known within the fire service. There had been no plans or alterations to procedures as a result of that.
The people who make those decisions to put flammable cladding on a building, you know what you're doing. You actually know what you're doing. When you do that, the possibility has been created. Now,
You can only do that in certain places. You can't do that everywhere. That can only happen in the place that nobody cares about. That could only happen in the place where, you know, you see those people as lesser than you, that you don't have the same levels of concern that you'd have for on top of the hill, yeah, up at the town hall or whatever, that you do for the residents of Lancaster West or North Kensington. Yeah, that's a contempt. That's something that's inbuilt into the culture of the people that are making these decisions. Those ones that are in the positions of power and privilege and abuse it because they can. So, you know, when they're doing it, it's a decision that's not based upon any kind of moral compass. It's based upon their own personal gain.
In the limelight.
Between a third and a half of the world's wild tree species are threatened with extinction, posing a risk of wider ecosystem collapse, the most comprehensive global stocktake to date warns. Forest clearance for farming is by far the biggest cause of the die-off, according to the State of the World's Trees report, which was released on Wednesday, 1st of September 2021, along with a call for urgent action to reverse the decline. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Jonathan Watts. The piece is titled, "Up to Half of World's Wild Tree Species Could Be at Risk of Extinction." Please stay with us for more of Jonathan Watts's article. Between a third and a half of the world's wild tree species are threatened with extinction, posing a risk of wider ecosystem collapse, the most comprehensive global stocktake to date warns. Forest clearance for farming is by far the biggest cause of the die-off, according to the State of the World's Trees report, which was released on Wednesday, 1st of September, along with a call for urgent action to reverse the decline. The five-year international study found 17,510 species of trees are threatened, which is twice the number of threatened mammals, birds, and amphibians and reptiles combined. This was 29.9% of the 58,497 known species of trees in the world. But the proportion at risk is likely to be higher, as a further 7.1% were deemed possibly threatened and 21.6% were insufficiently evaluated. Only 41.5% were confirmed as safe. The problem was evident across the globe. Brazil, home to the planet's most diverse forest, the Amazon, had the most 1,788 threatened tree species, including bigleaf, mahogany, rosewood, and eugenia. In China, the world's sixth most biodiverse nation, magnolia, camellia, and maple were among the 890 species of trees which were at risk. Tropical island states, notably Madagascar, are disproportionately affected, particularly ebony and rosewood. But even in Europe, which is relatively poor in terms of natural diversity, there has been an alarming decline in numbers of white beans and rowan. In North America, pests and diseases are causing severe losses of ash populations. Botanists describe trees as the backbone of the natural ecosystem. Although only 0.2% of species have become extinct so far, the authors say an accelerating decline could have dire knock-on effects. Humans are directly affected by the loss of carbon sequestration, oxygen production, timber for construction, fuel for fires, ingredients for medicine and food, buffers from storms, and the well-being that comes from shade and beauty. Arguably more important are the indirect impacts on the natural life-supporting systems. In many parts of the world, trees are the pillars of a healthy ecosystem. Without them, other plants, insects, birds, and mammals struggle to survive. Trees are essential. It's like a Jenga tower. Pull the wrong one out and the ecosystem falls apart, said the report's lead author, Malin Rivers, the head of conservation prioritization at Botanic Gardens Conservation International, or BGCI. When I look at these numbers, I